Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of September. In what's been called a stunning reshaping of America's financial landscape, two venerable Wall Street firms, as you know, fell from the shockwaves of a credit crisis that has plunged the financial system into turmoil. Stocks tumbled across the globe on Monday, the Dow Jones down 504 points. Lehman Brothers, the very old bank burdened by $60 billion in real estate holdings that have gone bad, filed for federal bankruptcy protection in U.S. bankruptcy court after attempts to rescue Lehman Brothers failed. The Bank of America Corporation snapped up Merrill Lynch and Company in a $50 billion stock transaction. And there are concerns about other venerable institutions today and as this week goes on, and people are jittery about the money they have in the stock market. There are some news reports that those of lower income who are trying to get credit may be hit hard by this. The political campaigns have blamed each other for what's happened here, and we'll talk about different political philosophies from the Republicans and Democrats, if there are any, to get the market back on track. And we'll also talk about the action that the Federal Reserve may take regarding interest rates coming up later today. So we try to make sense of all of this, and I am certain that you will want to join, many of you, the conversation. You can at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or if you'd like to send an email, that's available to you as well, and that is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Peter Morici is our guest, professor of international business at the University of Maryland. He has served as director of economics at the U.S. International Trade Commission, where he provided international economic policy advice to the House Ways and Means and Senate Finance Committees. He is the author of 18 books, including Reconciling Trade and the Environment in the World Trade Organization, Reassessing American Competitiveness, Labor Standards in the Global Trading System, and the list goes on. And we already have almost all of our phone lines going, so there is tremendous interest in this topic today. Professor Morici, thank you so much for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
So tell me about the significance of what happened yesterday. Some have said that it is a stunning reshaping of the financial landscape, and we haven't seen anything like this in years and years and years. How big is it?
Well, it is quite large, although this is a great opportunity for hyperbole.
Yeah.
One must remember that Lehman Brothers is not a savings and loan or a commercial bank like the one down the street from you that takes your deposits in. Lehman Brothers does have a brokerage that, like a lot of brokerages, has a money market facility. But by and large, it was an investment bank that went astray. An investment bank is a bank that helps companies issue new stock, that assists in mergers and acquisitions, things of that nature. Historically, merchant banks or investment banks were separate from commercial banks until Glass-Steagall. A lot of people are saying, well, this shows us we need Glass-Steagall. Well, the purpose of Glass-Steagall was to keep investment banks from bringing savings banks down. In reality, what happened was Lehman Brothers got into the commercial banking business, and it was the commercial banking business that is bringing the investment bank down. Essentially, they got into the business of buying mortgages from banks in your neighborhood and all around the country, bundling those into bonds and selling them to investors. That is a necessary exercise for us to have adequate mortgage money in the United States. However, they had a lot of sharp young folks there with very sophisticated degrees in economics and finance, like the whiz kids at Madison or the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota or Wharton. And they decided they needed to be paid a great deal of money because, after all, they're so terribly smart for having spent 4 years of the taxpayers' money studying economics at the University of Wisconsin. So what they did was they started bundling up high-risk mortgages. Now, high-risk mortgages, you know, pay a higher rate of return. They got bigger fees, and so you can make more money. But you usually have to give that money to the investors that buy the bonds because of the higher risk. But these smart guys said, well, you know, we can get rid of that risk. We can lay it off through derivatives and other fancy transactions. Well, you know, that's like trying to turn dust into trees or salt into gold. It's just absurd. And so what happened was these bonds failed. As they failed, the bank got stuck with a lot of them still on its books and others that were pushed back on them because of relationships they had with investors, and they basically have to make good on the money they borrowed to finance these bonds, and the bonds are failing because the mortgages are failing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lehman Brothers fails. My answer to that is, so what? Wall Street is full of firms like this. It's full of investment banks and some commercial banks that have played this game, and some insurance companies that decided they were bankers. But the bank down the street from you, go on down there. The doors are still open. The doors are still open. Your deposits are still insured. And what we've got here is an opportunity for great hyperbole. You know, if you're running CNBC, which is backing Obama, you want the world to be coming to an end, and you also want viewers. So even if you're not backing Obama, you want the world to come to an end. So you go on there and say, well, the entire financial landscape has been reshaped. It reminds me of when John Chancellor used to do the news on NBC, in which every day something of historic significance, not seen since the age of Pericles, had happened. The reality is the U.S. economy hasn't changed very much from a week ago. Essentially, a lot of derivatives dealers are going to lose their jobs. But the American banking system is still there, and it still has problems. But it basically has the problem that it no longer has these banks available to take the loans your local bank makes, the good loans, and bundle them into bonds and sell them to insurance companies and pension funds. So there has been, long before this breakdown, for the last 9 months, a shortage of mortgage money and business loans in the United States. Well, we're not going to get rid of that shortage until we get rid of these hustlers. And that's why the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers was actually a good thing, because what we're going to see is a house cleaning on Wall Street as these bad financial institutions, rejected by the discipline of the market, go away, and other regional banks largely take their place. Eventually, within a few years, we'll go back to business as we did, but in the meantime, we're going to continue to have a shortage of credit in the United States. But Lehman Brothers going bankrupt didn't create that. It was the hustling that it did 9 months ago, 2 years ago, that created that, and mm-hmm. the other banks as well.
What makes you say CNBC is backing Obama?
Well, I was just watching them question McCain this morning. And even McCain said directly to the interviewer, well, I know and understand you're sympathetic to Obama. And my feeling is that networks do have biases, and it cuts both ways depending on which one you watch. I bet you if we could take a quiet poll at Wisconsin Public Radio that most of your correspondents would be voting for Obama if we could get a quiet poll.
Yeah, well, that's not what we're talking about today.
Right? I understand. Right. I understand. But the point is that the media does have an agenda. The media does have an agenda, and part of its agenda is to just get viewers. And so when something like this happens, it gets blown out of all proportion. I really should have omitted the Obama comment when I made that, expressed that sentiment, because you really don't need that to have that happen.
Mm-hmm.
You have to remember who Paulson and Bernanke were being advised, and I was so amused over the weekend monitoring the situation. They were conferring with Vikram Pandit and John Thain. After Lehman Brothers, it is likely that Merrill will go. But Merrill's being acquired by Bank of America, a good old-fashioned regional bank from Charlotte, North Carolina, that's not in trouble. There's an example of a good bank that's going to take their place. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Bank of America, they're only using the old San Francisco name. They acquired the old San Francisco Bank of America, but that's a regional bank that outgrew the Nationals. That's a good example. But Vikram Pandit and John Thain were advising Paulson and Bernanke. But the thing is, after Merrill and AIG is a solid insurance company that got involved in all this nonsense. The insurance company will be sold off, and the rest of the stuff will fail, and the stockholders will lose everything. But the insurance company is solid. After those guys, the next people on the block are likely Citigroup, well, and Merrill and J.P. Morgan. I mean, it's that simple.
So who at this moment is losing a large amount of money? Who will lose money? And is it affecting at this point? We keep hearing news reports that those who might be most deeply affected right now would be more low-income people who will find it very difficult to get credit.
They've already had it very difficult to get credit. And credit card debt is liable to become somewhat more difficult because the banks were still securitizing credit card loans in New York because they run MasterCard and Visa. Now, Citigroup is still doing that, and the demise of Lehman Brothers has no impact on that at all. I mean, we have already seen a hiking of credit card rates and tougher terms and all the rest of that business. And mortgage money has gotten scarcer. Even Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the terms there have gotten tougher, even before their rescue.
Mm-hmm. So why would the government, I don't understand this, take over Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, but stay out of the business of Lehman Brothers? And
okay. Well, Fannie and Freddie hold 40% of the mortgages in the United States, and they make most of the low-income and middle-income loans in the United States. Also, Fannie and Freddie were always deeply entwined with the government, and part of the problem there was the relationship between those institutions, which are right here on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, and the Congress. I mean, the Congress got them to do things they shouldn't do, and also they got the Congress to free them from regulations they shouldn't have been freed from. You know, when people say that what we really need to do is regulate the banks, they need to look at what was going on with Freddie and Fannie. Freddie and Fannie were regulated, so what they did was they developed an extraordinary expertise in lobbying the Congress. And we've discovered that the Congress is corruptible. I mean, frankly, Fannie and Freddie were allowed to do things that no reasonable economist would permit a bank to do if he was in charge. For example, make loans on a capital of 1.5% of loans is absurd. A well-capitalized bank of that size should have 7.5%. To give you an idea, the multiples weren't even close. So to say that, you know, turning this over to Congress and people like Senator Dodd and Bonnie Frank is absurd, because they had the opportunity to run 40% of the U.S. mortgage finance business, and they made a total hash of it.
Let's go back to this giving high-risk mortgages to people. We've heard a lot that...
Please define high risk. Are you talking about a 10% down mortgage for a carpenter making $40,000 a year with a solid income record? Or normally a conventional loan would be 20%. Are you talking about the subprime nonsense?
I don't know. I don't know what kind of... But
well,
that's what we're hearing.
You know,
we're hearing.
This is an example of, you know, how... You got to tell me what you want.
Yeah, I am. I'm trying to ask the question.
Okay.
If you use the word high-risk loans and people... was greed and people trying to give loans to people knowing they were going to make fast money from it and that they were questionable loans because people may not be able to pay them back, was that part of the problem, a big part of the problem here?
Well, part of the problem were mortgage brokers around the country making subprime loans, loans to people with spotty credit histories and spotty income histories. The two things you look at when you loan somebody some money are their cash flow, their ability to pay the loan if they continue to receive money as they have. What's the history of that cash flow? Have they been on the job 5 years, 3 years, 1 year? How secure is the job? And just their credit worthiness. Some people pay their debts, some people don't. It's that simple. Most people do. Most, the vast majority of people will go to great lengths to pay their debts. So you want to eliminate those that don't. Well, they made loans to people who essentially didn't have the income to support the loans. Sometimes they were speculative in nature with low initial payments on five-year balloons that would were hopefully to be refinanced when housing prices kept going up. So the assumption was that housing prices would keep going up. They sold these loans to outfits like Lehman Brothers, who in turn bundled those into bonds and sold them to investors. They were sold in a way that fooled the bond rating agencies into thinking they were solid loans, though the bond rating agencies didn't try very hard to see how solid the loans were. And investors gradually started losing money as the loans would default. Say a bond was backed by 1,000 loans. Instead of having one or two out of 1,000 fail, you'd start to have, you know, 70 or 80. And at that point, Lehman could no longer sell the bonds for what it paid, you know, the loans for what it paid for them. And the house of cards started coming apart.
Mm-hmm. What about the action the Federal Reserve is expected to take sometime today regarding interest rates? What's that likely to be? What should they do, in your opinion?
Well, either going to stamp out or lower interest rates. It's hard. Well, and you'd say, gee, we didn't have to have an economist on here to tell us that. The reason I say I don't know is because what they do has no consequence other than psychological. Because the banks are no longer, the New York banks are no longer bundling mortgages into bonds to sell to investors, as they should be, so that your bank has liquidity. Mortgage rates have gone up even as the federal funds rate has gone down. The connection between the federal funds rate and the cost of business loans and mortgages to solid customers, I'm not talking about subprime customers, has become disconnected. Therefore, cutting interest rates will have no consequence other than to say, look, we're doing something. It's like hand-waving. This problem has existed for some time now, and the Fed has taken no steps to correct it. It could have been corrected. It chose not to. So it's culpable for neutering itself. Likewise, all of the money we borrow from the Chinese, because we have a huge trade deficit, mm-hmm. with China, tends to suppress long bond rates, or basically make them independent of the federal funds rate.
Let's welcome phone calls. We have all our phone lines going, so we'll take them in a moment. And if you'd like to join us, you can eventually at 800-486-8655. Send an email at talk@wpr.org. Professor Peter Morici is our guest, professor of international business at the University of Maryland. He served as director of economics at the U.S. International Trade Commission, where he provided international economic policy advice to the House Ways and Means and Senate Finance Committees. We'll be with you in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll talk about middle school students, a neglected group, our guest believes, and we will talk about how to inspire them. The author of If Holden Caulfield Were in My Classroom, Inspiring Love, Creativity, and Intelligence in Middle School Kids. Let's go to your phone calls now, and we start with Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning. For your guest, as far as I can figure, investment bankers had essentially three things going for them, and those were cash, bright guys and gals, and the trust of the people in what they were doing. Cash, forget about it. Bright guys and gals, in a very individualized, pecuniary sense, not in a societal sense. And last of all, trust, which seems to be pretty bruised at this point, not only in the USA, but globally. When the great crash happened in the 20s, at the end of the 20s, America was actually a fabricating nation. That is, even when financial services went into a dysfunctional phase, we were still a nation that had something to trade with the world. The corporatists in our culture had not chased down the cheapest labor in the world, because basically they said they were building a society in America where people were supposed to be earning enough money so that we could become a powerful economy. Now, after 30 years, and I know about this because I was in a sector where we were told it's moving to services, it's moving to services, it's moving to services. What we have essentially, I think, is not just a psychological downturn or a problem with bruised trust. Essentially, what we have, if you watch gold prices and oil prices and speculation on them, we have people who, when they're in financial danger, are not able to speculate, to buy up on oil futures and gold, because those things are not responding in the way that they normally would in such a situation where people would run for safety. In essence, what I'm saying is we're broke, and you're not telling us that we're broken.
Professor Morici.
Yeah, I see the reader read my op-ed yesterday. I wrote that what investment banks have going for them is capital's smart finance guys, he added gals, and trust. That's why I asked where he got that from. My feeling is that we owe the world too much money, and that is part of our problem, and I agree with you. We do need to accept globalization. It's a process that has existed since the dawn of man. And to say that globalization is good or bad is like saying the weather is good or bad. The weather is something we have to cope with. We probably are in a lot of trouble because we're borrowing so much from the world, and we shouldn't be. And that needs to be fixed. If we weren't borrowing so much from the world, then we wouldn't be consuming more than we're producing, and we'd likely make a lot more things, and I say things, stuff you can touch here, and that would be a good thing. And the question is, how do we fix that? We can't just fix that by putting up trade barriers, because all we'll become is an inefficient, protected society, much as the Chinese became in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries and ended up getting carved up by the West. Rather, we need enlightened policies that will help us rely less on the world in places we shouldn't rely on them. For example, energy. We need to conserve energy more effectively than we do, and we need new energy sources. But we have to be realistic. We can't do it if we're going to rely simply on wind power or the things the Sierra Society would tell us we should rely on. What I tell people when I give speeches around the country is that we need to do everything the environmentalists want us to do and everything they tell us not to do. You know, we do need to develop alternative energy sources, and we do need to drill offshore. On the other hand, I'm often confronted, because I'm kind of popular with conservative manufacturers, they'll say, well, gee, if we drill in Alaska, won't that solve our problems? There's not enough oil up there. The fact is, none of the solutions offered by anyone on the right or the left will solve the problem. It's really going to take a whole panoply of solutions, and they're all there. And if we added them up, but we're kind of locked up right now in the Congress and can't get much done.
Well, let's identify more of those solutions, because people would like to know what the solutions are.
Well, for one thing, we probably could improve the mileage in our cars to 40 or 50 miles to the gallon over the next 10 years without a whole lot of difficulty. And this isn't like when I was a kid at the Department of Energy, where we were talking about taking people from station wagons. We didn't have vans in those days and SUVs, and putting them in Chevettes. But rather, I can build you a pretty darn good SUV that gets 40 miles to the gallon. It's somewhat more expensive, but people buy cars too often anyway, so if you just hold them on to them longer, it'll come out the same. We likely could significantly increase our use of natural gas if we drilled for it. There is substantial renewable energy out there. We could generate a lot more electricity from nuclear power, and which is a heck of a lot safer than the coal plants we're building and a lot more consistent with our global warming challenges. It's things of that nature.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Matthew from Madison next. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, how are you, Kathleen?
Fine, Matthew. And you?
I'm well.
Good.
I've just got a couple comments, and I'll take my reciprocation off air. I would love to see the American financial and corporation system fail across the board right now. I think it's time for a reset. And along those lines, I think if we don't have an overhaul, we're not going to catch the middle and lower class back up to the white class to get back to where we need to be. We need to focus on locally charged businesses, locally charged what have you. You know, we need to get back to the grassroots of America. And before we do that, we're not going to catch ourselves up to where we've already set the bar. And until these men and women who are making millions and millions and millions of dollars over and over and over across these years, with their, you know, we're not going to get to where we need to be. And I'll just take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Matthew.
Well, in the United States, unless we're talking about a rocket launch, we have an established order. And the nature of our political process is such that we just can't start over with anything. And our financial system is so complex and huge, we just can't start over. We can't say, well, we need to just shut it down and build a new one, or re-regulate it, or bring back Glass-Steagall, or outlaw light bulbs and go back to candles so we don't use so much electricity, whatever. We have to basically change what we have gradually and make changes at critical points to get what we want, because that's the nature of the way our political system works, and that's just life. So the notion of just shutting it all down and starting over is silly. Also, the notion of rolling back the clock. Like, I was on Dobbs last night, and in the green room where you wait, one of the panelists said, well, I'm in favor of going back to Glass-Steagall. Well, we don't live in the world that Glass-Steagall regulated. We didn't have the kinds of financial instruments and the competition globally then that we have now. The fact of the matter is Glass-Steagall was designed to keep investment banks from taking down commercial banks. In reality, it's the commercial banking activities that are taking down the investment banks and insurance companies in New York. It's an irrelevant comment. Or comments like Obama's that, well, we need to tell those guys in New York that if they want help from us, then they need to be regulated. They're already heavily regulated. They're just not properly regulated. Or McCain saying, I'm going to have a national commission look at this. That's what he said this morning. To be fair, and by, I'm not, by the way, working for either camp. And we're going to have like a 9/11 commission. That's silly. Every time we have a national commission to fix Social Security, to plant new peach trees in Iowa, or whatever it is, the commission comes up with really bold frameworks that never get adopted. We need to go to New York and get fixed what is not working right now, and then look at ways of removing the incentives that created this mess. One of them are these $100 million paydays that people are getting for destroying venerable banks and companies and so forth. You know, what's going on in New York reminds me of what Bill Veeck said when he owned the Chicago White Sox. He was a bit of a character, still is. He owns a baseball team in Minneapolis last time I looked, or if he's still alive, that is. And he said, it's not the high cost of greatness that bothers me. It's the exorbitant cost of mediocrity. And what we are paying, you know, it's like paying, you know, $10 million a year for a 230 hitter that plays shortstop for the rinky-dinks. It's, in New York, what really bothers me is paying people like Vikram Pandit $200 million a year to destroy Citibank, which is exactly what's going on.
Yeah. What about the president's comments yesterday? He said, we are working to reduce disruptions and minimize the impact of these financial market developments on the broader economy. Two questions here. What is the administration doing to reduce disruptions? And secondly, what do you anticipate will be the effect on the broader economy?
Well, what it has done all along is, and what we've done, it's really not so much the administration, it's the Federal Reserve, which is an independent entity and reports to both Congress and the president. Okay, bear in mind that Bernanke, that Bush cannot fire Bernanke,
mm-hmm.
Is that they have provided a lot of liquidity to the banking system. It's because at times like this, the banks have trouble getting the funds they need to keep us from having failures we shouldn't have. To some extent, the administration is provoking the adjustment that is inevitably going to happen by shutting Lehman Brothers. And to some extent, it chose Sunday to be the day we'd have the disturbances. You must recognize that the U.S. Corps of Engineers can't stop a flood. All it can do is save the people that are in its wake. And a lot that very much applies to global financial markets. This is not something the United States government can control or even regulate. All it really can do is manage the disaster, and that's what they're trying to do. The statement they made yesterday was the kind of statement you would expect. You've got the media with all of its hyperbole making the problem worse. You've got people like Vikram Pandit and John Thane running around saying we need a bailout, AIG saying we need a bailout or the world will come to an end. I assure you, the insurance policies at AIG are as solid as your grandmother's teeth. People with those insurance policies are going to get paid whether or not AIG fails. But they run around and say, you know, if we don't get this money, the world's going to come to an end. And then the Wall Street Journal prints what they say, and people panic further. So what you saw was what presidents do on these occasions and say, we're working really hard. Because a lot of people have a misplaced faith in the government to actually do something in a situation like this.
John from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. My question is kind of related to the national debt and the interest rates. If I remember correctly, under President Clinton, he had spoken with Alan Greenspan. And one of the big things he did, or significant things that he did, was they refinanced the national debt to short-term interest loans. Now, President Bush was handed the largest surplus in the history of the United States. And with a good economy, he's created five of the largest deficits in the history of the United States and almost doubled the national debt. And I'm wondering if the size of the national debt and the fact that they refinanced it under short-term interest rates has throttled it so that they can't raise interest rates at all. And if it looks like we're going to be going into a relatively heavy recession, and if we were running five of the largest deficits in the history of the United States when the economy was rolling, what's going to happen when the recession occurs to the deficit? And interest rates seem like they have to be held low because we have a $10 trillion debt that was refinanced under short-term interest loans. So it sounds to me like the dollar, which has been falling dramatically, is going to get trashed even more when we're in need of money because they can't raise interest rates.
What's your question, sir?
What do you think?
What do you think of what he said?
Well, it was very complex, and he touched on a lot of different issues. So it's hard to just, you know, pick one thing out. But it really doesn't matter whether it's in short-term debt or long-term debt when the sovereign has a debt, because it can merely roll it over. Whether or not we have a large deficit or not, it is really complex. When Bush took office, he had a surplus, but he also was elected under a shadow. And there was an enormous pressure for a large and generous farm bill, which basically broke open the floodgates on government spending. And a lot of that pressure came from, I believe, not where I am standing, but where you are standing. And it was also with a Democratic Congress at the time. So, you know, it cuts both ways. It cuts both ways. Likewise, President Clinton's given a lot of credit for doing things like get rid of welfare and balancing the budget. He had a Republican Congress a good deal of the time. So, you know, it cuts both ways. And it's easy to be very partisan about this and to dislike the man. Also, it would be very difficult for the United States to have a budget surplus when it has such a huge trade deficit. And it'll be very difficult for the United States to get rid of its trade deficit until we do two things. Develop new energy sources, both of traditional kinds that Republicans would like and non-traditional kinds that Democrats would like. It'll be very difficult to do that as long as we have a president like Bush and a speaker like Pelosi, because if they have such entrenched views and so little ability to compromise. It's also very difficult to do that when China is pursuing the kind of currency policy it's pursuing, and neither a Republican nor Democratic president is inclined to stand up to China. We've had the same China policy, the same China trade policy, through two presidents of opposite ideological perspectives. And we are likely to have the same China trade policy with either man that is elected next time.
Thanks very much, John, for your call this morning. Our number is 800-486-8655. You talk about the same trade policy. Do you see significant differences between the two presidential campaigns concerning what's going on Wall Street right now or not?
No, neither one of them really offer much in the way of solutions. As I said earlier, Obama says something which really gives us no sense of direction, like, well, if they want to be helped, then they need to be regulated. Well, they are being helped and they are being regulated. It's like change. I'm for change. I don't know what he means by that. Change on a dollar? The kind of policies he's proposing sound like, you know, washed over policies from the 70s. McCain, on his side, basically proposes a national commission. Namely, he was going to not address the issue himself. He's going to try to find somebody else to address it for him. That's not very comforting when we're in the middle of a crisis. Policies he's pursuing remind me of the Carter-Reagan policies, which were basically deregulation, which have been useful to a point, but they obviously are not wholly useful. So my feeling is I'm not comforted by either campaign. They're basically absent without leave on the credit crisis.
Samantha from Madison. Bad phone, Samantha. Can I hear you? Yeah, if you can call back, we just can't hear you. There's too much noise. We go to Nancy from Minocqua next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, why are not bullet trains and mass transit ever discussed? It would put millions of people back to work and save tremendously on energy costs and give us a wonderful society of moving people around. We could get on a train and go from here to there instead of these single automobiles carrying one person for miles and miles. It makes no sense.
Well, in a nutshell, public transportation isn't terribly efficient and it requires lots of subsidies. That is partially due to technology and partially due to politics. On the technology side, public transportation really works best where you have dense populations and where transit authorities are free to build the lines where the people are, not where, say, city planners say people should be. If you look at New York City or Paris, it's a grid where basically anybody can walk to the train, so people use it. In more spread-out cities like Washington, where I live, they tended to put subway stations between masses of people because no mass of people was large enough to support the line. As a consequence, people have to take buses, train rides are very long, commutes are very long. So it sort of becomes a low-income mode of transportation, requires a lot of subsidies. When I was a professor in Minneapolis in the 70s, there was a study done in those days. I can't put my finger on it. But where they looked at, well, you know, putting mass transit in Minneapolis. And Minneapolis is a lovely progressive city that would support it, but the population is too spread out. You know, it's very easy to say we should be like Paris, but the reality is we don't live like Parisians. For better or worse, the country's built. Americans are very spread out and rely on personal transportation. And the only real solution is to make that personal transportation much more efficient. The Rocky Mountain Institute did a study, and I admit they're a conservative group, but their view is that we probably could so improve the standard forms of transportation that we use now, the automobile, that we could dramatically reduce our use of petroleum, and that would put people to work in a way that created efficient jobs. If we decided to move everybody around by train, we better be prepared, and to take away their automobiles, we better be prepared for a dramatic reduction in our standard of living, because it would require so many resources and be so inefficient that the overall productivity of our society would drop significantly.
We're going to pause for a moment and return. We're talking about yesterday's and continuing developments on Wall Street this hour of the program with Professor Peter Morici, Professor of International Business at the University of Maryland. You can reach us by phone at 800-486-8655, or you can send an email if you'd like, and that is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program after the latest news, the author of If Holden Caulfield Were in My Classroom, Inspiring Love, Creativity, and Intelligence in Middle School Kids. Our guest has been a principal, a director of teacher training, and a teacher in middle school levels for over 40 years. So that's coming up, hour number two. We go back to your phone calls, and let us try Samantha again from Madison. Hi, Samantha.
Good morning.
There you are.
Yeah, all I have is my own experience, but talking theory, I'm actually somebody who has lost everything. I, 2 years into a career, had built up all kinds of property assets. My property, saw before the housing bubble burst up, sold them, held on to the assets for a while, listened to a very good financial planner, bought into AAA-rated preferred stock. Those are Freddie Mac and Lehman Brothers. They are worth nothing now. I have nothing else. I am worth nothing. So to theoretically talk about these were investment bankers, these were big brokerage firms that did this, lower middle class, single parents, it happens to the person standing next to you. I wasn't playing the stock market. I made safe, conservative investments. I'm an intelligent woman. I am now on the other end of this. So I don't appreciate the theory all being thrown around like it's not affecting your neighbors. It is. And it's not affecting just people who are making millions of dollars.
Professor Morici.
Well, you know, one of the real problems we have in this debate is a misconception of who's gaining and who's losing. And we have this both on the right and the left. They love to demagogue problems and talk about fat cats and making the culprits pay. And in this case, they say it's the stockholders who should pay. The reality is the way Wall Street is working right now is that the big gains are being made by the executives. People like Vikram Pandit, who's put $155 million in his pocket, used some of that to buy Tony Randall's apartment in Manhattan, while his share prices are plummeting, and he's selling off new shares to the Saudis, raising new capital. And you say, well, who are these shareholders that are losing? Well, and they're the same shareholders that lost out at Lehman yesterday. They tend to be all of us, because most of us own the stock market indirectly through our pension funds or our IRAs and KEOs, and they're taking a beating. I mean, this notion, for example, of turning Social Security into private investment accounts, has anybody looked at what that would mean, have meant over the last 10 years? The stock market, until this debacle, had gone no place for 10 years. It had gone down by about, I guess, 15%. The S&P went from 1522 to the high 12s. So, you know, I do sympathize with you. We're all being victimized by this. And You know, people like Obama saying, well, we need to regulate what's going on in New York, and people like Bush or McCain saying, well, the stockholders have to take their hit, and Paulson making them take their hit. You know, over the last 2 days, the one thing I have observed is nobody has said a word about Mr. Fuld, the chairman of Lehman Brothers, not getting his severance package. He's going to get his money.
Right.
He's going to get his money. He's going to get his money. And Mr. Paulson's not doing anything about that. What's more, I want you to listen very closely. Have you heard Senator Dodd talk about that, or Barney Frank?
Well, I want to know.
No, hold on. Have you? Can you recall them saying anything about that? I know I'm being rhetorical. The answer is no.
I want to talk about Samantha. I want to know how Samantha can get her money.
Well, she can't get her money back. It's gone. I'm sorry, I can't answer that question, and you know that, and you're asking a question that you know that I can't answer.
No, I don't know you can't answer, and I'm sure she's not alone.
If you invest in preferred shares of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they're made worthless by the mistakes of their managers, it's gone. You can't sue for it back. It's gone.
I am wondering how many people are in her position today.
Well, we are all in that position to some measure if we have money in the stock market, because most of us are invested through our pension funds or our IRAs and KEOs,
right,
as I said. And most of us are in index funds, which means we own a piece of these companies. And that's one of the reasons when you get your quarterly statement, you're going to be down 15% or some percentage. And why we're all losing money on our pensions right now. And there's really, and it's because we're not running the system properly. Establishing national commissions or saying we're going to re-regulate Wall Street isn't going to fix that. What's going to fix that is going after the compensation packages of these people that give rise to the incentives to do the kinds of reckless things that have brought about the great New York debacle, which have destroyed the New York banks. But as I go back, if you want an answer as to what can be done about it for the future, then we have to find some way to disentangle these people from politics. Because, as I said, you don't hear Dodd or Barney Franks complaining about their payouts. And the reason for that is they collect a lot of campaign money on Wall Street, a lot of it.
Everybody does, don't they?
Well, no. Everybody does, but everybody doesn't. One of the things you'll see is Democrats complain a lot about oil company profits because that tends to be a Republican industry. Well, banking tends to be a Democrat industry. Look at who the vice chairman is of Citigroup. It's Bob Rubin, the former Democratic Treasury Secretary. You can rest assured, no Democratic president or congressional committee is gonna mine his pockets. They'll go after the Republican oil industry. And when the Republicans are in, we've seen what they'll do for the oil industry. Look at Cheney's work, okay? What I'm getting at is the banking system. The banks have become particularly adroit at working the political system, even more so than the oil companies. After all, if the oil companies were good at it, they'd be able to drill where they wanted. Well, the bankers have been particularly adroit, and they are drilling where they want to, in the pockets of the person that just called.
Thanks for your call, Samantha, and I'm sorry for you. That's a hard one, real hard one. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we go next to Sharon from Duluth. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I guess my story isn't quite as bleak as hers, but it's got a lot of similarities. I'm 65. I was planning on retiring next year. My employer has been gradually cutting my hours and kind of looking askance at my age, and I would like to hang on longer, but who knows? And no retirement plan. You're talking about pensions. I wish I had a pension, because I think at least with a pension, people could count on something for a while, but I've just had my private investment, and that investment has come at a lot of sacrifices. I realize now I should have put money into my house. I maybe should have taken some trips. I should have treated my kids a little. But instead, being single and having kids to raise, I've always tried to save every little bit I can. And so now I have a rundown house that needs a lot of work, and I have a pension that, or an IRA that has lost so much that my question for the guest is, How much time should a person in my situation and other people who are hitting that age and that's their only backup kind of look at maybe possibly being able to be, things get a little better?
My feeling is that things will get better within a year or so. One of the things that's being put out there is that, you know, we've had this earthquake of proportions we've never seen before. No, we've had an earthquake, and we have them all the time. This one's bigger than most. This is like a hurricane. This is a Katrina. Within a year or two, if we don't have another one, we will recover from it. And you'll find that if the politicians permit the regional banks to step up, they may do a remarkably good job of filling the void. But, you know, I do sympathize with you. I will be 60 this year, and my hopes for retirement are, you know, getting further and further away, just like yours, because my money is mostly in IRAs and KEOs. The professor's pension fund looks a lot like a KEO. It's a TI CREF basically invested in the broad stock market. And, well, you know where I am, in the same place you are. Our political leaders have failed us in the sense that over the last 10 years, the U.S. economy has grown. Corporate profits have grown. Incomes generally have grown, but average Americans have not enjoyed a piece of that. And the solutions being offered by the two presidential candidates offer us little hope. Barack's tax cuts will make you feel good for a little while. It's like a meal in a Chinese restaurant. You'll be hungry an hour later. And McCain basically is offering us more of the same. His economic advisors are downright frightening. So my feeling is that, you know, we're just going to have to continue working. I don't know when I'm going to retire any more than you do.
Thank you, Sharon, for the call. Keith from Neenah. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Keith.
I got a little scenario I wanted the guest to comment on. I had a discussion with one of my I'm a contractor working. I do architectural work, and I had a conversation with my boss a number of months ago, and he has a Lincoln Navigator, and I drive an electric hybrid. And our discussion diverged where I told him, I said, "Well, the problem here is when your company bought you the Lincoln Navigator, which it has a very low fuel efficient vehicle, you get to write off the whole vehicle because it's rated as a truck. And I have to write off my electric hybrid over a 5-year period." And I said, "Where can the where can our IRS, our tax laws, come into effect to help, you know, not incentive these huge vehicles that are gas guzzling, but to offer incentives to people like myself who are trying to do the right thing?"
Oh, my goodness. Well, our tax policies do permit us to write off commercial vehicles, whether it's a car or a truck, as opposed to a personal use vehicle. When it comes to personal use vehicles, we already provide incentives for people to buy hybrids. Whether or not that is doing any good or not, I cannot fathom to say, because I don't know that giving the automakers money to make vehicles that are more expensive makes sense. Is the structure of incentives, I don't know if it necessarily makes sense or not, but you did receive, many people who brought hybrids did receive a subsidy to do it.
And thanks very much for the call. We have time for, we're getting close to the end of the show. Anne from Madison, hi.
Hi, I'm kind of sorry about the attitude of your guest. He seems to have the idea that the little guy is going to lose 20% of his income. So that's just part of the cost of doing business, whereas Wall Street needs to be bailed out. But a recent survey reported that 70% of U.S. corporations hadn't paid any federal income tax for 2 years. In the state, the same thing happened. There was a series on it a couple of years ago in a Wisconsin paper. Where is this money for all these bailouts going to come from? The U.S. tax base and state tax bases are impoverished because many of the richest men in the world and their corporations are sneaky Pete's. They're taking a free ride on the shoulders of the average Joe, whose taxes are crushing them to compensate for their ability to refuse to pay taxes because they bribe federal and state legislators to
okay.
get rid of
them. We have about a minute left.
Well, you know, I did say that our government officials have let us down because ordinary people are not sharing in the prosperity that has been generated. So I don't know how. I guess I don't have easy answers for a system that's gone afoul. And I just don't. The fact of the matter is our political leaders from both parties have let us down. They have pandered to their own corporate interests on each side. And that's unfortunate, but it's true.
And thank you so much for being with us.
Take care.
Yeah, you too. Our guest, Professor Peter Morici, he's a professor of international business at the University of Maryland, has served as director of economics at the U.S. International Trade Commission, providing international economic policy advice to the House Ways and Means Committee. And he's also the author of a number of books, including Reconciling Trade and the Environment in the World Trade Organization, Reassessing American Competitiveness, Labor Standards in the Global Trading System. We'll be, of course, covering this story much more, as the national news will, and we'll get more of your response during other programs. I believe Ben Marins is talking about this afternoon, and we will probably be on the topic later in the week as well, because as you can see from our phone calls this morning, a lot of people have lost an awful lot as a result of all of this, and it's a fairly complicated topic that we need to understand better, and that's our job. We'll help you with it. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your intelligent, thoughtful calls. They are much appreciated. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with another hour of Tuesday Conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.